everything that appeared
before. NYC, a parapsychic radio show based out of New York City.
Join us each week as we journey into the unknown. Let's cross the threshold of reality together.
We take a fun and no-nonsense approach to our show, and we love to interact with our audience. Each week, you can expect a great guest, interesting topics, and strong opinions by myself and Stephanie.
As well as rapid readings, psychic dream interpretations, and the gemstone of the week. And don't ask us a question that you don't want an answer to.
Give us 2 hours of your time to inform, enlighten, and entertain you as the journey begins.
Join us.
Welcome, everyone, to this evening's edition of A Global Focus with guest Preston Dennett, author and field researcher. Topic discussion will be Preston's most recent book, UFOs Over New Mexico. Good evening, everyone. Thanks for joining us. This is Trish Sheridan speaking, and welcome to this July 6th edition of A Global Focus. Tonight's guest will be Preston Dennett. The A Global Focus program is broadcast live on 107.9 FM New Orleans and the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. Thanks to Joe Montaldo for making these programs possible. Also, guest details and program listening venues can be found at the show website, aglobalfocus.com. Our featured guest this evening, Preston Dennett, began investigating UFOs and the paranormal in 1986 when he discovered that his family, friends, and co-workers were having dramatic, unexplained encounters. Since then, he has interviewed hundreds of witnesses and investigated a wide variety of paranormal phenomena. He is a field investigator for the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON, a ghost hunter, a paranormal researcher, and the author of 15 books and more than 100 articles on UFOs and the paranormal. His articles have appeared in numerous magazines, including Fate, Atlantis Rising, MUFON UFO Journal, Nexus, Paranormal Magazine, UFO Magazine, Mysteries Magazine, Ufologist, and others. His writing has been translated into several different languages, including German, French, Portuguese, Chinese, and Icelandic. He has appeared on numerous radio and television programs, including Coast to Coast and the History Channel's Deep Sea UFOs and UFOs. His research has been presented in the L.A. Times, the L.A. Daily News, the Dallas Morning News, and other newspapers. He has taught classes on various paranormal subjects and lectures across the United States. Preston Dennett's website can be found at www.prestondennett.weebly.com. There also is a Facebook page. Preston, welcome to the program. This week I had the opportunity of reading your latest book, UFOs Over New Mexico. Your book contains numerous, well-researched, and detailed accounts. Due to the great extent of your research, even this two-hour interview can cover only a small amount of the cases in your book.
Thank you, Therese. I'm very happy to be back on the show and talk about my latest book. I had an amazing time researching it and writing it.
And it's an amazing book to read. So many details of accounts, so much new information. Now, Preston, you are a prolific author in the ufological ET research and paranormal fields. This book, UFOs Over New Mexico, represents your 15th book, with a 16th UFOs Over Vegas to be published next year. Preston, how did you get involved in this research? Your bio does allude to the motivations for your research.
Yeah, you know, I was a UFO skeptic growing up. Didn't believe in them for a second until I heard a report in the news and about a sighting over Alaska. And you know, Therese, I thought this pilot was lying. I thought he was on drugs or misperceiving. But he described, you know, a light following his airplane. I found out later it was actually a really quite dramatic sighting in which two objects, which were larger than his jumbo jet, followed his plane for about 20 minutes, I believe it was, and actually appeared on the onboard radar and on the ground-based radar, though the FAA later denied that and called it a split image. Now, all of this, none of that was actually on the news. It was really kind of tongue-in-cheek, and they made fun of it and laughed nervously, and I thought to myself, well, you know, this is a really strange news story, and I made a mistake. I called a mistake of asking my friends, family, and coworkers what they thought of this ridiculous pilot, and I'm going to say at least 25% of the people I've known for, you know, years and years and years came forward and told me that they had seen their own UFO or, you know, even been abducted, actually. There was, it hit me like a ton of bricks. It was not good news, and really kind of changed my whole worldview. I bought every UFO book, joined every UFO group, and went on a mission to find out that, you know, prove that, or actually to disprove this phenomenon. I was sure it wasn't real. I became obsessed with it pretty quick.
Well, you know, Preston, I too have had encounters, and I think you'd agree with me that in information, in knowledge, there is power. It's very proactive, I think, positive development to begin researching the subject and trying to acquire answers from the various sources. Now, Preston, your book, UFOs Over New Mexico, is the first work to comprehensively describe the UFO encounters in that state. Now, Preston, could you tell us about the uniqueness of New Mexico as far as heightened UFO activity and the long history of reported events in New Mexico?
Yeah, actually, this is kind of part of the series, which I started with UFOs over California, and that was followed up by UFOs over New York. And I was kind of picking the states I think that were the most influential in terms of how we view the UFO phenomena. And New Mexico is definitely one right up there in the, you know, top five of really important UFO history. And I think it is different from each state kind of has its own unique flavor, if you know what I mean, to encounters. And Mexico definitely is a little bit different from other states. For one reason, I mean, it's got a lot of what you call atomic installations, like Los Alamos, and a lot of research into atomics. And I think this is one of the reasons we have a very high number of UFO encounters over New Mexico. And so we have major, major encounters occurring very, very early in UFO history over New Mexico. And what really makes New Mexico different, I think, is it has more UFO crash accounts than any other state by several orders of magnitude. So New Mexico is definitely unique when it comes to, you know, the various states and their histories of UFOs.
And, you know, your book contains such a large assortment of cases, both at military installations, airports, and also in the New Mexican towns and cities where there have been so many sightings. Now, Preston, you've referenced the apparent interest of UFOs over military facilities, nuclear research facilities, research and development facilities. Your book does contain several reports of sightings by military personnel and also scientific personnel, engineering personnel at various locations. A number of those sightings have occurred over the White Sands Proving Grounds. Preston, you note in your book that the White Sands Proving Grounds is the location where the United States Air Force conducted tests in aeronautics, rocketry, and atomic research.
Right, you know, it's very, very interesting when you look into the whole phenomenon of UFOs, and it becomes immediately apparent, if you know, investigate these cases objectively, that these aliens, I'm going to call them aliens, I think that's the best theory, extraterrestrials, are very, very interested in our research, not only in atomics, but in anything having to do with space travel. And I can march out case after case in every, you know, state I've researched so far. Certainly California has a number of cases like that, and New York as well. Even New York had one case, you know, just a tiny little offshoot, where a father and a son launched a toy model rocket, and a UFO came up and circled around this toy. So clearly they are interested in a case that illustrates that in New Mexico occurred, you know, even before Roswell, way back in like 1947. This was actually on May 15th. This is a case which really caused a lot of concern at high levels of our government, because this was the first time that they could not deny it. They had launched a V-2 rocket, and the rocket failed, actually, when this UFO showed up and started circling it. And so clearly this object not only was interested in the missile, but caught off. This was through telescopes, theodolites, which are cameras attached to telescopes so they can tell exactly the size and speed and that sort of thing. It was clearly not one of our objects. But huge, huge, huge deal, and kind of started the whole cover-up, really.
Now, Preston, I remember two of those cases that you referenced there. First of all, in my notes, I referenced the case that you first spoke of, the May 15th, 1947 V-2 rocket launch at White Sands. Now, this apparently was accompanied by an unknown aerial object observed by radar technicians, with the commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Harold R. Turner, later noting to intelligence investigators the factor of, quote, peculiar phenomena, end quote, observed by the radar technicians. And, another V-2 test that really apparently had some UFO occupants interested was the case, June 29th, 1947, where there was a sighting by three naval research scientists waiting for the commencement of a test involving a VU. Preston, you give so many of your witnesses have very high credentials. You also have the other spectrum where they're fine citizens and also scientists or workers at the airports. Something that I find interesting as well, it's a slightly different science area, the geophysics lab. You note on this concept of facility research and the appearance of UFOs that in one incident, Navy missile trackers and a scientist, these people also were trained balloon observers, were conducting tests at the Holloman Air Force Base geophysics lab section when they observed an unknown object fly at, quote, tremendous speed, end quote, over the Holloman base. That would be remarkable.
Oh, absolutely. And like you said, these are really highly trained citizens. Approximately two-thirds of New Mexico is owned by the federal government, actually. And this is one of the reasons I think there's a lot of cover-up of these events. I mean, we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg. And in that particular case, the scientists were able to train theodolites. Again, these are telescopes, cameras. We were able to track these objects.
Mm-hmm.
And they measured their speed at 18,000 miles per hour, which is way faster. And this was actually turned out to be investigated by Project Blue Book, and even they could not, dismiss this case. Blue Book is, widely considered to be sort of a way for the Air Force to get out of the UFO problem, and
mm-hmm.
It wasn't really a serious investigation. But in this case, Blue Book case number 139, they unidentified, they could not figure out what this thing was.
Boy, that's interesting. And, before Project Twinkle, I just wanted to note here that you tie in the ends so very well here. Preston, you note that some of the Project Twinkle researchers were able to catch on those theodolites, images of classic UFO saucers. You've got this great case, White Sands Again Proving Grounds, on April 24th, 1949. And you note that the commander, Robert B. McLaughlin, he was, quote, chief of the Navy's guided missile program at the base, end quote, noted possibly non-terrestrial source of these sightings in a press conference and later statement to a magazine. So not only are these witnesses highly credentialed, but they are freely discussing the topic that these craft might not be from Earth.
Oh, yeah. I think it was pretty much, and it's obviously known at some level that these craft are not from Earth. And but the farther down you go in sort of ranks and need to know, people do not know about this stuff and don't take it seriously. So there's sort of a dichotomy, and it's almost psychotic the way mm-hmm. our government is dealing with this. On one hand, denying it, and on the other hand, you know, debunking accounts. There's a lot of cases like that in New Mexico where the Air Force aggressively goes after witnesses and calling what they saw weather phenomenon and things like this. So, yeah, it's a crazy situation. And really got crazy with all of Project Twinkle when hundreds of these green fireballs started, and these were not meteors. So that was a real big deal.
Boy, that's for sure. And now you note that from December 1948 through April 1949, that's quite a period of time, the Air Material Command officials received at a minimum 39 reports on these green fireballs. So apparently they were throughout that area, or seen rather throughout that area.
Right. You know, and initially, of course, they were thought to be meteors, but these things are, you know, different from meteors in a number of different ways. First of all, you know, they're bright green, usually, and they travel a horizontal path, and their speed is kind of much less than the meteor, but, you know, of course, faster than any known aircraft. There's no trail or dust cloud, and they're very, very fast. And here's the weird part. They only show up in New Mexico, and which is kind of, you know, the astronomers could not figure that part out. Honestly, I think it had something to do with the atomics, because this is where all these objects were being seen, was in the area where we were doing major atomic testing. We covered, you know, they spent a lot of money trying to record, never were able to record them, you know, with various instrumentation and, you know, manning all these labs. And it went on for years and then suddenly just stopped. It's very bizarre.
Very interesting. And, you know, you just referenced, of course, your book details, the contributions by Edward Ruppelt. Now, he's a U.S. Air Force officer. He also, wasn't he the director or a major figure in the Project Blue Book program? I think you just referenced that as well.
Yes, he was.
You include in your book just a super quote. This is from page 24 of your book, and here you're citing Edward Ruppelt. Quote, "Everyone, including the intelligence officers at Kirtland Air Force Base, Air Defense Command people, Dr. La Paz, and some of the most distinguished scientists at Los Alamos had seen at least one," end quote. And that's referring to these green fireballs. Well, those are people with high credentials.
Oh, yeah. Well, how about Clyde Tombaugh, the discoverer of Pluto?
Wow, yes. Mm-hmm.
He absolutely saw them, and not only that, he saw a major UFO sighting, a solid craft, on himself. That was on, August 20th, 1949. And he was outside of his house with his wife and his, and they saw it off in the distance, and this object was not a plane. It had portholes, and it kind of just went there across the sky off in the distance, and after that sighting, Clyde Tombaugh became very, very vocal about UFOs and often spoke of, you know, the veracity and how he complained about how astronomers weren't taking this phenomenon seriously and really tried to, you know, turn the UFO movement and people take this stuff seriously. And he wasn't really that successful and was always disappointed, actually, by people's lack of interest.
That would make sense. And stand right there with your phone. For a minute before, we couldn't hear it too well, but now we can. And, Joe, if you could just kind of keep an ear and eye out there to make sure that the sound comes through clear, because, boy, Preston's information is, and many others, is very, very important. Now, you know, I want to kind of jump ahead. Well, actually, we can jump ahead because your accounts range from the 40s all the way up to 2010. And now, here I'd like to note something from 1950. Preston, you note that the Atomic Energy Commission, or AEC, in 1950 prepared a questionnaire for the public in apparent response to a wave of UFO sightings over nuclear installations. You describe the questionnaire as having 26 questions, with the requested information including a detailed description of the object, its luminosity, means of propulsion, and odor. Now, did that surprise you, Preston? To me, I found it surprising.
Yeah, it did, you know, and I think I'm continually surprised to find that pretty much every intelligence gathering organization within our government, you know, has files on UFOs. FBI, CIA, NSA, the USAF, they all of them are having to deal with this phenomena, and largely undercover, unfortunately. So it's a very curious situation. Yet even now, we're still dealing with this UFO cover-up, which I think is crumbling to a large extent. But absolutely, yeah, that did surprise me. And you know what's interesting about that questioner is we never really heard anything about it after that. And but what it does make clear is that the Atomic Energy Commission was absolutely aware of these sightings and wanted to get information about it and went to the public. So, it's extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. And, you know, I've noticed, too, about two or three references to J. Allen Hynek and his assessments of different accounts. And there are at least two, if not three, in your book where J. Allen Hynek, in reviewing the reported cases over these military and research and development installations, indicated that he found high credibility in the witnesses and also incident elements that seemed consistent with an anomalous incident.
Yes, yes. Hynek is the founder of modern ufology, and he was assigned as an astronomical consultant to the Air Force, basically to downplay the sightings. And as time went on, he found that this was a real phenomenon, and there was many sightings he couldn't explain. And it was around this time, you know, information was actually starting to be kept from him. The very best cases were being routed away from Blue Book. He never got to see them. And he was absolutely dismayed at the way our Air Force bungled this whole phenomena. And according to Hynek, Blue Book officers spent a lot of time debunking cases, and whenever they came across a case which looked promising, they refused to investigate it. So there you go. There's our tax dollars being spent.
And, you know, Preston, right now discussing some of the newer cases, but you know, some of the accounts really created a great vignette scenes in my mind. For example, you describe a Holloman event in September 1956. It was west of Holloman Air Force Base on the White Sands Proving Grounds. It was one where a UFO appeared. The engines of several cars stalled, their electrical equipment having failed, their engines having failed, and reportedly dozens of the witnesses were Holloman Air Base employees, and witnesses viewing the event from the base itself included two U.S. Air Force colonels as well as two sergeants and others. Now, these type of events must have created some type of stir.
Oh, absolutely. And, in fact, it created a huge stir, and because these types of cases were not really heard of before. We had cases where UFOs were chasing cars, but as far as stalling, not so much. And the fact that there were so many going all across New Mexico over, you know, a whole month, and it was extraordinary. Some of these cases involved multiple cars, and one gentleman, actually, he was thumbed by a UFO. This was a really actually well-known case, Officer Stokes, and he got out to look at this thing, and it shined down a light on him and causing a sunburn. And so, extraordinary, and I think these cases are really kind of caused concern at high levels of our government, because for the first time they had to consider the possibility that these stallings were being caused not accidentally, but intentionally. So possibly that these objects that were chasing our cars down the road were testing their ability to stop our vehicles. Because certainly there's a number of cases over cars chasing down the road, and the car does not stall. And so suddenly to have all these cases, you know, actually going right down into Texas as well, where UFOs were stalling cars, I think the government thought that these were hostile cases, where the UFOs were actually using what amounts to a weapon to stop our vehicles. At any rate, you know, it was a kind of an isolated event, and there wasn't anything quite like that before or since, really, anywhere in UFO history. This was a really extraordinary rash of car stalling cases that remains unparalleled, really.
Yes, you know, Preston, on that case you referenced regarding Mr. James Stokes, I have it in my notes here, November 4th, 1957, a Holloman Air Force high-altitude missile engineer and Navy veteran, James Stokes, was driving in the proving grounds area when the radio failed and car engine stalled. Now, other people's cars stopped as well, and I guess people were pointing at this huge glowing object, estimated at from 300 to 500 feet, performing unusual aeronautic maneuvers, as you describe. Stokes estimated that the high speeds reached an estimate of 2,500 miles per hour. Boy, that would be quite a scene there to observe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, he regretted going public and later denied, actually, his story at some point, but then, you know, told the truth again. The Lorenzans, the UFO investigators who investigated this incident, were able to find several other people who also, you know, saw the stuff at the same time. So it's absolutely an extraordinary case, and, yeah, Stokes regretted ever going public with it. As many people did it at that time. You know, incidentally, people I went interview, you know, who have had abduction cases and sightings,
right.
I always ask them would they like to be anonymous or not? And I would say about half people have no problem with it. And these people have never had any problem as far as harassment or going public. So I think we're at the point, this information is out there, it's open, and there's very little the government can do to stop this flood of information. We'll see what happens.
Preston, that would be a wonderful development. To me, this information is just too important, and it's impacting so many people. And, of course, the importance is of a major nature. Let me see here. Down on my list, oh, wow, so much information. Now, Preston, what was the Farmington UFO wave? Was this the event? March 17th, 1950, hundreds of unknown objects in the sky over Farmington, New Mexico.
Yeah, so what did you ask about that?
And wait one second. Great, now I can hear you. Say two words, I want to make sure I can hear you well.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked
Sounds good.
About this. Because this is one of those cases that is kind of unique in all of UFO history. And this occurred over the small town of Farmington, New Mexico, which incidentally is where a UFO, very near where a UFO crashed 1 year earlier. And some researchers think that it's a possibility these UFOs were putting on sort of a display. At any rate, what happened was sometime during the early morning, these objects appeared over the town of Farmington. They were at first just a few, but very quickly they became very numerous, and people, this literally stopped the town in its tracks. People came running out into the streets, cars stopped on the highway, businesses stopped, everyone went running out to look at this massive display of literally hundreds of objects. They were darting around, some were moving in clusters, kind of as if they were together, and others were moving independently at right angles. There were some large objects where smaller objects were coming out of, sort of a mothership. There was a few red objects, and it was just an extraordinary display, and it went on for hours. There was kind of a break there at one point where the objects went away, and then they came back again, and again, hundreds of these things. And now, there were a few people who tried to debunk this, saying that these were not UFOs at all, but rather bits of paper blowing in the wind. Now, the witnesses, if you read their testimony, there's absolutely no way that these were little bits of paper. Even the Air Force tried to debunk this as well, calling it a shredded skyhook balloon, a weather balloon. And again, there's just it doesn't match the evidence at all. And furthermore, the Air Force not only debunked this, but threatened witnesses, told them not to talk about it, told them they should forget it, that it wasn't important, and various things like this. And also printed, you know, very little. They refused to issue any explanation, and the next day the newspapers just went crazy over it. So it was a huge press event as well. It's really an extraordinary.
You know, to me it sounds very warranted that it would be. And, you know, you've continued your information on Farmington. You noted that on March 17th, 1950 is that tremendous Farmington event. But decades later, on July 31st, 2010, three men outside a Farmington gas station, you report, observed a UFO of a triangular shape, a large object, flying in their direction at an altitude of less than 500 feet, and the sighting was reported to MUFON. That would be a remarkable sighting as well.
Oh, yeah. That's how many years later is that? And these objects are still flying around, and often they have no fear of being seen. So it's odd. I think they're kind of doing sort of a grassroots movement, if you will, where they show themselves to first one person, and then to other, and then to groups, and almost kind of getting us used to their presence. Because, you know, the evidence, the stories that have come out indicate that these objects did try to contact our government, and we're not very successful at it. And basically what happened is we were very hostile towards them and tried to shoot these objects down. And certainly that's what happened during the Washington Nationals in July 1952. We chased after these objects, which were basically, you know, hovering right over the White House, right over Washington, D.C.
The Capitol.
Exactly. So, you know, people often ask, why don't these objects just land on the White House lawn? Well, they tried to, and what did we do? We chased them. And what's really interesting is right when this, you know, was going on, there was it ended up causing one of the largest press conferences in U.S. history over, you know, any subject. That was on July 29th, 1952, when General Samford was, you know, talking about these Washington Nationals. At that exact time, all of New Mexico were experiencing this huge wave of sightings. While they were trying to debunk it in Washington, the actual UFOs were flying around and just being very busy right over New Mexico. So it's one of those weird coincidences.
You know, it would be, and you know, you beautifully expressed this event in your book, and you also note as well that among those New Mexico sightings, Los Alamos, on that day, of the press conference in D.C., July 29, 52, on that very day, Los Alamos was the site of a series of daylight UFO observations. And to me, that's really a very powerful point, Preston. It's sort of a concurrent events that really point to the importance of an issue. Preston.
Right. And these people who were watching these UFOs were, you know, bomb site officers, scientists, weather personnel, colonels, news reporters. It was just impossible to deny that something was going on. And the 1950s were just incredible in terms of just levels of UFO activity that was going on, particularly over New Mexico.
That's for certain. And, you know, Preston, you, in your research, you also give commendations to the work of past others. For example, you mentioned the excellent work of APRO, the Aerial Phenomenon Research Organization, with founders Carol and Jim Lorenzen. And one of the key cases that you mentioned, and I think it's cool because the witness is an engineer, a senior engineer, is a very powerful one. Now, let me see here. I'm trying to think the date here. Well, it's that of Carl Hawk, an engineer from the Sandia Corporation, who with a friend Marvin Harvey on the base observed a jet fighter and then an unknown rectangular object, a UFO. And I'm trying to see here. Let me open up to the page to see if I have the date. I had noted the dates. I think I forgot to.
Yeah, I think that was January 1952.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, yes. And, you know, too bad that all the reports weren't so objectively received, because I guess Carl Hawk, the engineer, also was a fine illustrator. And he and his friend were observing the movements of this craft. The object was seen near Tijeras Canyon and then flew to downtown Albuquerque. And you very carefully note there, Preston, that Air Force personnel seemed to take Mr. Hawk's submitted formal report with the illustration and UFO description very seriously. To me, that's really proactive, and it's extremely positive. They're getting information. They're responding to it in a very positive way.
Oh, yeah. They're very interested in people who are qualified observers, at least at that time, who have seen UFOs and are very interested, you know, to hear what they saw. Well, absolutely. They take this subject seriously and interviewed that gentleman, and were very pleased that he was able to, you know, draw this UFO exactly like he had seen it. And another extraordinary case occurred on August 13th, 1956. And this was a Navy pilot. And he was actually flying his private Cessna 170 to Albuquerque when three UFOs started circling his plane very closely. And it caused his compass to wobble back and forth and kind of spin, and really caused him a lot of concern. These were not lights. These were actually three round gray machines is how he described them. And they were passing right in front of his cockpit windshield. So extraordinary maneuvers of obviously nothing we can do. And so he flew off to Kirtland Air Force Base. And when he landed there, he was interrogated by an Air Force major who, again, took his UFO sighting very seriously. And this major actually told him that having been so close to one of these objects, there was a big possibility he could develop a radio sure to let him know and that the Air Force would take care of him. So, of course, which really alarmed the pilot, and thankfully nothing happened. But they swore him to secrecy and begged him not to tell anybody. And he eventually did go public and reported his sighting to NICAP. And so we're lucky to hear about this, but clearly there's been other cases where that Air Force major would not have been so concerned or had that kind of knowledge, saying, you know, that they've had other people, obviously, who have suffered radiation sickness from being too close to these objects. And certainly there are cases like that. There's a couple, in fact, in New Mexico where some really alarming UFO injury cases.
Yes, they were. And let's get front to my notes here because, I found them to be rather moving cases because two of them, or the two that I remembered, did impact on... And let me see if I...
Right.
Yes.
Well, I know which ones you're talking about because those cases really affected me too. One occurred on April 29th,
yes.
1964. And these were actually both occurred in 1964, these children cases, so it's kind of interesting. And one occurred in Albuquerque to a young girl named Sharon Stahl. And she was on the playground at school when she saw an object over the playground there. And she was trying to figure out what it was. And she kind of felt like maybe it was looking at her, kind of affecting her in some way. She couldn't really tell. But no one else seemed to be paying attention. However, after this sighting, she had to be rushed to the hospital because she had severe eye irritation and burns apparently on her face, and which she attributes to this object. And this is where it gets really weird. Over the next couple of weeks, she grew majorly, like 2 feet, and again, which they attribute to this UFO. She also psychologically changed, started, you know, talking much more maturely, and it was just a bizarre case where... And there's a few other cases like this in the literature, but just so, so few, where UFOs cause sudden growth. And that's what happened to her.
And, you know, Preston, now I have my notes on the other case. This was June 2nd, 1964. It's an event where, a reported event, where an 8-year-old boy in Hobbs, New Mexico, Charles Keith Davis, was burned in a reported UFO event. Allegedly, he was playing outside and hit by what, from the description, seemed to be to possibly be a ball of fire or flame. The child did heal. He didn't suffer pain during the healing from the burn injuries, and I'm just hoping that there were no permanent physical scars or some type of impairment from this. I'm hoping that he truly healed and well from that.
Well, I certainly hope so, because it's an alarming case.
Mm-hmm.
His grandmother said that his ear was so cooked by this, it looked like a piece of meat.
Mm-hmm.
And the child actually thought he was going to die. And these were second-degree burns to the head and face, and the doctors could not explain it. No one could explain how these burns happened to him. And no one actually even got a really good look at this object, which apparently came swooping down kind of like a toy top shape, and hovered right above the child's head, pouring out this gray soot and fire. And this is another case that did cause interest in the government. In fact, the FBI heard about the case and requested samples of the boy's hair, T-shirt, and actually his skin as well. And the boy's grandmother absolutely complied and sent the FBI the material and never heard back. And so this is another case where the government really kind of covered it up.
And, you know, I agree with you that this type of event might represent hostile action, one that would really demand the attention of the authorities. Certainly that would be a very negative event to have occur to someone. Preston, on the sort of a counterpoint, you note in your book healings, at least two in your book, reported by individuals who believe they've been visited by UFO occupants.
Right. There was one lady in Deming, New Mexico, who had been suffering from dizziness as a result of her medication. And she said that ETs came, I forget the date of this one, but ETs came and actually healed her. And so, yeah, but I'm getting more and more cases. That was actually the subject of my first book, UFO Healings,
yes. Mm-hmm.
And many years ago. And I outlined 100 cases. And now I'm going to say that there's probably about 200 at least recorded in the UFO literature. And I hear more all the time. And so I think, you know, these are the types of cases that don't get a whole lot of attention because they're still kind of relegated to the outlandish fringe aspect of UFOs, unfortunately, because they provide some really good medical evidence, I think.
Yes, that was a very interesting book of yours as well, Preston. And, you know, your research here, right at that time period, 1964, now it's a year later, 1965, you know that there were some truly remarkable UFO waves that were reported the night of August 2nd and 3rd, 1965. You note thousands of UFOs being reported in the central part of the United States.
Right. It's very interesting. UFO waves are very localized, and other times they're right across the United States. And this was a huge one, and absolutely there was a lot of activity in New Mexico as well. One lady in Deming, she saw an object which she described looking like a giant acorn, and it was flying silently right at treetop level. The whole family actually watched this object from about 150 feet from their home. And afterwards, it was being followed by another object, a large round silver object, which was kind of hovering there, perfectly still in the sky, at an absolute standstill for like 4 hours, I believe it was. And this was right in the middle of the town of Deming, so probably a lot of people saw it. And apparently, that's true because three fighter jets actually, came out and approached the object, at which point this object, which they described, as being about the size of a football field, shrank down to the size of a dot, literally, and just vanished, which kind of shows that these objects can move interdimensionally, and they're not really aerodynamic, I think, as we can think of it. They don't move in the way we are moved at all. And for that, in addition, size doesn't really matter when it comes to UFOs because they have the ability to change the size of their craft, which I know sounds extraordinary, but I'm getting more and more of onboard cases where people have been taken on these craft and watch these rooms shrink down and then expand. And it's really interesting when a witness will tell me this and says, I always ask them, well, how big was the UFO? And I says, it was changing size. So I've got reports of people from the inside of these craft and reports from the outside. So clearly these objects are very, very advanced and have something, I think, to teach us about traveling. Now, this is how they get from various star systems. There is apparently some sort of faster-than-light travel.
You make some very good points there, Preston. And two comments here. First of all, one of our researchers, an excellent researcher in the room, is asking where you live in New Mexico. And, Preston, if I remember correctly, you live in California. But now recently you did visit Roswell, correct? And it sounds to me as though you truly have visited almost every section of New Mexico in your research.
Well, I do have friends up in New Mexico, and I was able to stay there. I've been to Roswell, of course. I also attended the 50th Roswell anniversary. Yeah, I'm very familiar with this state. It's a beautiful state. And what's interesting about New Mexico is also, I might just kind of as an aside, is they are very high in minerals and ores and things like this. And this, I think, might be one of the reasons that UFOs are very attracted to New Mexico, which is very similar to New York, which also has some rich deposits. And New Mexico is very, very high in uranium. And clearly, the UFOs are all about atomics. They're very, very interested in atomics. I think some of the UFOs are powered by atomics, as evidenced by the fact that people are getting radiation burns. But at the very least, they're very interested in atomics. There's so many cases of UFOs hovering right over nuclear installations, nuclear missile silos, even shutting them off. But there is no doubt these objects are very, very interested in our atomic research. That's, again, why New Mexico is so rich in these types of cases.
Excellent answer. Thank you, Preston. Now, Preston, we have two further questions coming in from our room. Our network room is always visited by excellent researchers and very knowledgeable visitors as well. We welcome them all, and they always add a great deal. Now, two additional questions. Now, let me see here. Jim, from our researcher, Jim, I'm trying to find the specific question. I believe it relates to the fact of sightings around the time of the Northeast blackout in 1965. And I remember in your book, you noted that there was a similarly, not quite as large, but still a massive power failure on December 2nd, 1965, a month later, over portions of Mexico as well as New Mexico and Texas, and that there was an unverified report of a UFO being seen at that time.
Yes, what's really interesting about this is UFO-related power-outs were kind of a new phenomenon. And the New York power outage, that affected a good one-fifth of the nation at least, and was really the biggest UFO-related power outage in history. And really caused a lot because it wasn't the only one. And that year, there was one in New Mexico as well, and there was several in other areas of the United States. And the one in New Mexico occurred on December 2nd, 1965, and there apparently was UFOs seen, though these reports were kind of unverified. They couldn't confirm them. But Donald Kehoe, the guy who investigated this, he's a UFO researcher, pioneering, actually, from one of the first UFO researchers, really, in the United States. And he wrote that there was a chain reaction blackout, which affected stores and homes and hospitals and airports and also air defense bases, including Holloman Air Force Base and White Sands and several others. So it's really kind of an extraordinary thing when you think about this, that UFOs are actually causing these power outages. And in the New York blackout, there was one gentleman, an actor, who said that he was actually contacted by the ETs on that night, and they told him that, yes, they did cause the blackout, and it was a demonstration, concerned about our warlike ways. And he bravely went public with his account. So I think this is why they're doing it. I mean, they're definitely kind of not only testing their own abilities to paralyze our whole society, which apparently they can do pretty easily, but they're concerned about our warlike ways. And this is something that turns up again and again in contactee accounts, people who are taken on board, abduction accounts. The very most common thing that happens to someone when they're taken on board is usually a physical examination, but right second to that is warnings of nuclear proliferation, warnings of pollution, environmental disaster, and things like this. And right behind that is, messages on alternative healing and psychic development and self-improvement in various ways. I can't tell you how many contactees or, abductees I've talked to who are now environmentalists. They're planting trees. They're doing organic gardening. They're trying to save homeless animals, cats and dogs, and very concerned about this type of thing. So I think this really points towards the question of UFO hostility. which is, of course, you know, the million-dollar question. Why are these objects here? And I think these types of cases we're finding out more and more. I think if you look at this really objectively, that they're not hostile. And despite, you know, the whole abduction phenomena, that they're very interested in us and our planet and preserving it.
You present some very interesting points there. Very well said, Preston. Also, we have two additional questions coming in from the room. First, from our policeman there in the Northeast. He's wondering if UFOs ever shot down, were ever shot down or damaged by our jets. And our other researcher, another excellent researcher there from the southern states, is wondering... He's noting that there was a series of military and civilian plane shoot-downs in 52 after we ignored the aliens buzzing Washington, D.C. Those are interesting developments as well. Certainly, some of the information that's come in has been startling.
Absolutely. And I think our government is kind of hostile towards this. Not our government, some aspect of our government. And by that I mean some group of people have control of the UFO hardware. They have control of the whole UFO situation. This is a kind of a paramilitary, partly of the industrial military complex. It's hard to say who exactly these people are, but certainly the military is implicated heavily in covering this up. And I believe they are shooting down these objects, and New Mexico has more UFO crashes than any other state by far. And I think at least some of these crashes were caused by us. It's hard to say for sure, but there are so many cases in New Mexico of UFO crashes that it's hard to believe these things are just falling out of the sky by themselves. I mean, obviously these are very advanced craft. Something is causing them to crash. And, for example, in the Aztec crash, the object was unmarked. This was a UFO that crashed in 1952, I believe it was. I can get the exact date for you. 1948, actually. Or some researchers say 49. But this object was crashed pretty much fully intact except for one small hole in the object. And hard to say what pierced this craft, but it caused it to crash, and it took the Air Force quite a while to open it. But the Aztec UFO crash is considered very important because apparently we got a lot of technology and from that craft, and we're able to understand quite a bit about the ETs and their craft from that particular incident. But there's so many. I mean, one really bizarre case involved a emergency nurse who was brought to an accident scene on the highway.
Yes.
And she thought, oh, you know, this is a child who's been burned. And the police officer was there saying, no, you know, I'm not so sure this is a child. And they took this victim by ambulance to their little hospital there, their little emergency room, which was just a tiny little emergency room. This wasn't a major hospital.
Was this the Santa Rosa? I'm sorry, please pardon my interrupting. This was a case, it sounds similar to, but it's different from Santa Rosa that you described.
No, it's the, in 1963, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, you know, normally this type of incident would have been a big deal, but it was completely covered up and no one talked about it afterwards. But what's very interesting is these bodies were brought into the hospital, and the doctors were testing them. And the nurse was looking at them, and they took x-rays. And she says that these bodies reminded her of children dying of famine in Africa because they had very thin bodies and huge, large heads. And she wasn't even thinking aliens at the time until an Air Force colonel shows up and demands that the bodies be removed. And then he begins to remove every single thing that had anything to do with it. Took the x-rays, took her notes, stripped the ambulance completely, and so it was really shook her up really bad, and she ended up, you know, she wondered what had happened, and it was a little, you know, it took her some time to really put together the dots and realize this was not even a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And she actually did see the crashed object as well, but it was completely destroyed, and so she couldn't really make much of it. So it's a very interesting case, and one of several in New Mexico that are really not that well known.
Well, that's intriguing information as well. And, you know, Preston, we have about 2 minutes to our between the hour 10-minute break. But I just wanted to note here that we have two questions. We have actually probably three questions coming in. And one of them is from our another excellent researcher, Steve. And he's referencing a Snippy the Appaloosa horse, 1967, that animal mutilation. And your book gives an excellent chronology of New Mexico cattle mutilation events. Also, Steve has a question. From your research, Preston, why do you think the aliens abduct us? He believes that their technology should allow them to understand everything they need to know about us just after one abduction. Any thoughts there?
I wish I knew the answer to that, and I think this is the first thing all abductees are trying to ask the ETs. Why are you doing this to me? What's up? We don't know the answer to that question. We do know they're interested in us. That is apparent. I do believe that they are taking our genetic material. I think that's pretty conclusive if you look at all these reports. And why they can't get their own genetic material, it's hard to say. It could be that they're testing our bodies for levels of pollution and things like this, our immune system. Certainly this is one of the reasons for implants. I've gotten 6 or 7 accounts of people who've been told why these implants have been put in their body. And it's not only for tracking, or not even really necessary for tracking at all, but rather to boost the immune system or measure the levels of pollution in somebody's body, or measure the various biosystems, you know, the heart rate and things like this. So I think that there are positive reasons why these ETs are here. And again, I'm going to go back to their agenda. Their main agenda does seem to be warning us of nuclear proliferation. One gentleman, you know, and environmental collapse and disasters and pollution. One gentleman I spoke to, he had an incredible encounter with these 15-foot-tall praying mantis-type ETs, who he was not abducted. He was invited aboard. He went aboard voluntarily, but it was a very, very scary experience for him. And these ETs told him that when we started our atomic testing way back in the early 1940s, it kind of started a countdown clock. And as a result of our reckless behavior with this technology, it's going to cause huge climatic change. And they basically showed him, actually, predictions, prophecies, which played out in full color, in 3D, of various disasters that would happen to us. And he says some of these have already happened. And but they said it's inevitable that, you know, as a result of our messing around with atomics, we've caused a lot of damage to our planet. And I think that's one of the reasons they're here, honestly. I think also that they have a connection to us. I think the fact that they are human-looking aliens, absolutely human-looking, really raises serious questions about human origins and our relationship to these ETs. And, in fact, some of the ETs do say that we are related. Tell witnesses this all the time, and these reasons is they feel sort of connected to us.
Those are very thoughtful responses, Preston. We will be taking a 10-minute break now. I still have further questions from the room and several questions of my own. I can't wait to discuss your cattle mutilation research. Also, further interesting UFO sightings. They span the decades. Several questions and several very intriguing questions, as I noted, from the room. We'll be back in 10. In the interim, please check out Preston's website at PrestonDennett, PrestonDennett, weebly.com. See you in 10.
breaking news. Strange black pyramid UFO ships over every major city on the Earth. People are exhilarated and scared. Reptilian strange creatures are beaming down. My God, they're beaming me up with them. Don't put that probe there. Don't put that probe there. Don't put the... Listen to the Church of Mabus radio show at 11 p.m. Eastern, Saturday nights with host Jeffrey Pritchett, bringing you The High Strange. Visit www.churchofmabusradio.com. That's www.churchofmabusradio.com.
Hey, hi there. Got your attention? I'm Gia Scott, and I was curious what you were doing from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time on Tuesdays. See, I host this really interesting little radio program that airs live then, and we bring in all sorts of guests. Authors, experiencers, and everything in between. It's paranormal and guaranteed to make you go, My guest list is always up at www.giascott.com, and do tune in to the Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesdays.
With us, Chip and Nicole, every Monday night.
From 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. Eastern on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, as we delve into UFOs, abduction, ghosts, aliens, conspiracy, cryptozoology.
And don't forget those creepy topics you won't hear in your local news.
That's the Mind Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest.
Don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Facebook.
Hi, this is Rob Simone, and I want to tell you about my brand new show here on the Paranormal Radio Network. Each week, I bring you the most interesting people on the planet, the most in-depth discussions, and the most controversial issues. We go where no talk show dares to go. Join me every week for the Rob Simone Talk Show here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Hello everyone, Trish Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Come join us each Friday evening at A Global Focus's new time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Come join the discussion.
Are you a fan of the unknown?
Do you constantly watch the skies, wondering if there's something out there?
In fear of things going bump in the night?
District Radio brings you head first into the world of the paranormal with the latest news and interviews with the paranormal elite.
With hosts Jordan Klein and Nick Queen, you are sure to be consumed in the world of ghosts, UFOs, cryptozoology, conspiracy theories, and the unknown.
So check out Whispers Radio every Tuesday night, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 to 7 Central. And give us a call, 1-866-514-6.
Visit us at www.whispersradio.com.
To UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, everyone. This is Second Sight NYC. You can join us each Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
We're a parapsychic radio show that isn't afraid to push the limits.
We have limits?
Well, if we do, we haven't found them yet.
Chris is the godfather of psychic mediums, and he'll give you a reading you can't refuse.
You better believe it. And Stephanie is the co-hostess with the mostest.
Relax there, Chris.
Yeah, okay. Second Sight NYC is the show that even the spirits listen to.
How can you make such a claim?
Well, the spirits told me. Give us 2 hours to open your minds to the possibilities of what could be.
This show is all about what is seen and unseen, known and unknown, and everything in between.
Each week, we make the unbelievable believable.
Join us.
Are you a fan? No.
Do you
constantly watch the skies, wondering if there's something out there in fear of things going to bump in the night.
This is Radio brings you head first into the world of the paranormal with the latest news and interviews with the paranormal elite.
With hosts Jordan Klein and Nick Queen, you are sure to be consumed in the world of ghosts, UFOs, cryptozoology, conspiracy theories, and the unknown.
So check out Whispers Radio every Tuesday night, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 to 7 Central. And give us a call, 1-866-514-1600.
Visit us at www.whispersradio.com.
Light up your night with the Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, everyone. I'm psychic medium Christopher George, and I have a new show that will air the first Friday of every month from 11 to midnight Eastern Standard Time. The show is called Insight with psychic medium Christopher George. It's all about readings. I welcome my listeners to call in for a free reading. Just remember, don't ask me a question that you really don't want the answer to. I'll give it to you the way the spirits give it to me. Straightforward and real. The first Friday of every month, Insight, 11 to midnight.
Welcome back, everyone, to A Global Focus with our guest, Welcome back, everyone, to A Global Focus with our guest, Preston Dennett, author and field researcher. We are discussing Preston Dennett's most recent book, UFOs Over New Mexico. Preston Dennett's website can be found at prestondennett.weebly.com or prestondennett.weebly.com. The second hour of the interview now resumes. Global Focus with our guest is noted Preston Dennett, author of so many books, including his latest, UFOs Over New Mexico, website prestondennett.weebly.com. At this point in the program, I'd like to mention to our listeners very briefly to not miss the excellent programs on our network. Now, these include a live broadcast immediately after this program from 11 p.m. to midnight Eastern Time, a new program, Insight, with host psychic medium Christopher George. He also is co-host of Second Sight NYC on Thursdays. But again, stay tuned tonight for an additional new show, Insight with psychic medium Christopher George. It'll be immediately after this program at 11 p.m. Eastern. Also, other shows on the network that are very popular and informative as well are UFO Undercover, Wednesday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern with host Joe Montaldo. Also, Second Sight, NYC on Thursday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern with co-host Stephanie Benetti and psychic medium Chris George. Now, on Friday evenings, immediately prior to this program, Through the Keyhole with Aaron Dolan from 7 to 9 p.m. Also, Saturdays, Jeff Pritchett hosts Church of Mavis Radio, that is from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. Eastern, and on Mondays, Chip and Nicole, plus your co-host, Mind Cemetery, another very dynamic new program from 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Now, let's get right back to this interview. Preston, you know, I think it's so commendable that you have written an extensive list of books on UFOs centering on the various sites. You've really memorialized both to researchers, experiencers, and to the general public the fact that these events did occur over the decades and their importance. Now, Preston, I'd like to also bring up several further subjects in your book. Number one, you have included accounts of experiencers from New Mexico that I hadn't heard of previously, but with very interesting accounts. For example, Preston, your book describes an intriguing case concerning a Dr. Daniel Fry, a missile engineering executive employed for an Aerojet group at White Sands Proving Ground. His case has been reviewed by such ufologist researchers as Timothy Good. What happened to Dr. Daniel Fry?
Yeah, Daniel Fry is one of the contactees from the 1950s who most UFO researchers have largely panned and kind of ignored these cases. Some researchers do take Daniel Fry's case seriously, and I'm one of them, and I know Timothy Good is as well. And it's an extraordinary case. He is actually, you know, a scientist, and was outside of his base there where he worked, and came upon one of these craft, which was actually landed on the ground, and he was able to walk right up to it and almost touched it, in fact, when he heard a voice which said that he's better not, as he could get hurt. And this started this extraordinary encounter case, which is really kind of unique in the literature. Daniel Fry was able to go on board this craft. There was no one inside. It was remotely controlled. And he spoke with an ET remotely, using kind of a telepathy type of communication. And it was extraordinary. He was able to actually go up into the atmosphere and go travel to New York, he said, and look at the city lights and travel several different locations. And before he was returned, and was able to get quite a bit of information to ETs on why they're there and how their craft work and all this sort of information. And he had contacts after that as well, and was not going to go public, but later did go public with his accounts and wrote a whole book about it. So yeah, it's an extraordinary case, and some researchers, again, don't take it seriously, but I think the ones who have seriously looked into it do take it seriously. And he was an engineer. He did not want to go public with this, and he was actually able as well to take some extraordinary photographs, which have not been debunked as well. So it's really quite a case.
Sounds very intriguing. And, you know, Preston, among the other cases you note, is one regarding the abduction of Sergeant Charles Moody. Now, boy, that's one intriguing case. You mentioned that he was a United States Air Force flight mechanic at Holloman Air Force Base on August 13th, 1975. While watching the Perseid meteor showers, he noticed an object which began to approach his vicinity.
Right. Yeah, that is, I think, probably New Mexico's most famous abduction case. And initially, he didn't realize he had been abducted. Like many people, he had what you would call missing time. What happened is he did go out to watch this meteor shower and had sat down and wasn't out there very long when he saw what he thought at first was a shooting star, but it wasn't going away, and it came swooping down and approached very close to him. He heard a high-pitched whining sound. He saw oddly shaped windows, and he could actually see human-looking forms through these windows, at which point he became kind of numb and felt sort of dazed a little bit, and suddenly the craft left. It lifted away and just moved away. And he looked at his watch, and it was at least 2 hours later than it should have been. And his back was hurting. He had a strange rash on his body. And wondering what had happened, he immediately contacted UFO researchers. And it was over the next few weeks that he naturally remembered everything that happened. And it was an extraordinary, extraordinary story. He watched it come out, and they were sort of like the typical grays, but more human-looking, and about 5 feet tall, with large heads, no hair. They had very small ears, and they did have a nose as well, but weren't quite like the typical gray, I guess you would say. And they talked through telepathy and were wearing jumpsuits, and they dragged him right out of the car, and he resisted at first. And but they dragged him right on board, and after that, it's a very kind of friendly contact, really. I mean, they started answering his questions, and after you know, they had taken him to this room and sort of did an examination of him and healed him, actually, of where they had injured him when they were dragging him on board. They started talking to him, and he asked them if he could see their engine room, and they said, absolutely. And that's what happened. They went to the engine room, and sort of the floor gave way like an elevator, and they went down into this room that was about 25 feet across, and they saw this huge rod going through the room. And, you know, he tries to describe this thing that crystals and balls and rods and things moving around, but he was not able to really understand what this engine room, how it worked, rather. And the ETs did tell him that they are working with several different alien races. They told him that he would probably not remember what had happened, but that his memory would return over the next few weeks. And they also told him that they would come back to visit him again. Now, it's not clear whether they ever did, because Sergeant Moody was transferred, you know, as UFO investigators had predicted he would be. His employees, his superiors, immediately transferred him after this incident, somehow found out about it, and shipped him overseas. And now that's the last we've ever heard of this guy. So it's an amazing case, and pretty well verified, and certainly classic, in terms, because this was before the abduction phenomenon was really, you know, popular and publicized, rather.
That does sound like a very intriguing case with many interesting aspects, including the missing time as well. Also, that his memory is actually back to him naturally. That, too, is an interesting aspect. It does happen to some experiencers. Now, Preston, you also know you have other case accounts here, too, that are very intriguing. One is, and I'm just going to describe it as a new cadet. I won't give the name in case he's still serving. You note an interesting account from the New Mexico Military Institute located at Roswell. Very important institution there. Several of their graduates are accepted into West Point. Now, in September 1972, new cadet at the New Mexico Military Institute, en route to meeting his squad leader, actually viewed or reported viewing a UFO from a stairwell window. And I think a kind of intriguing connection to this is a very brave veteran and well-known author in the field, Clifford Stone, served on the military instructor staff at the New Mexico Military Institute. And, of course, Clifford Stone has authored two books, his latest being Eyes Only, The Story of Clifford Stone and UFO Crash Retrievals. So it's kind of an interesting New Mexico Military Institute aspect there to ufology.
Yeah, it is interesting. What's interesting is this UFO is being seen right over this highly militarized area.
Yes.
And actually had missing time, apparently, because he was on a very tight schedule at the time he was, you know, due to go see his superior for an inspection, actually.
Yes.
And this UFO shows up. And he was watching it for, he thought, only a minute or two, and kind of lost sense of time, apparently, because after this UFO went away, he immediately continues on his way to his superior and gets completely chewed out for being 20 minutes late. So what happened to that 20 minutes is the question. What's really interesting is, you know, he later, years later, went under hypnosis and was not able to recall any information on this missing time. And whether there was a really strong memory block or whether nothing actually happened, it's hard to say, but 20 minutes disappeared somewhere, because he was certain he was not watching that object standing there for 20 minutes. That was, you know, just a couple of minutes. So it's really interesting. He's still looking for information on anyone who, you know, has seen anything around that time, which was, you know, September 1972. So, yeah, really interesting case. And what I find most fascinating about it is, you know, its location. Like you said, the New Mexico Military Institute. Clearly, they're making an impression on people who are going there. And I think when someone sees a UFO that close, it's clearly aware that they're being seen. They're trying to make contact. This isn't what you would call just a simple sighting of an object flying by. I'm much more inclined to think this was an onboard encounter, actually. So if someone's actually being abducted right out of the institute, well, I don't even know the implications of that are.
Well, you know, you do reference this well in your book that under this hypnosis that he was feeling strong emotions, and that would suggest perhaps an event, or at least that would be my humble opinion. But, you know, the account that you've included is very, very intriguing. And, you know, Preston, Oh, before I hit cattle mutilation, you've got a great segment. You have several, actually, chapter segments on cattle mutilations. I just wanted to note a further sighting. That would be the February 11th, 1989, a sighting by Richard Souter. He was viewing a UFO over Albuquerque. He actually then saw two and then later a cluster of smaller spheres. This is just so cool. Now, Richard Souter, I did guess correctly, he is the author of that very famous series of books on underground bases, tunnels. Right. And you note that he saw two unusual objects in the vicinity of the Sandia Mountains. He subsequently saw two fighter jets from Kirtland Air Force Base racing to the Sandia Mountains. And then he saw a small cluster, quote, a small cluster of five glowing colored spheres, end quote, as noted from your book. Boy, that's an interesting sighting. And I guess he had some interesting, there was an interesting aftermath to that as well.
Right. Oh, yeah, there was interesting repercussions because of how he reacted to this sighting, which, you know, occurred on a daylight sighting on February 11, 1989, not that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually lives there in Albuquerque, or did at the time, right very, very near Kirtland Air Force Base, and overlooking these Sandia Mountains, which, you know, rise about 10,000 feet. And he's watching these objects darting back and forth when these jets come, and it's just a huge display of objects with jets chasing them. And he's very intrigued by it, so afterwards he starts talking about it and goes to local researchers, who says, you know, why don't you call up Kirtland Air Force Base and report your sighting? And so that's what he does. He calls the public affairs office at the base and speaks with Sergeant Bernheisel and reported his sighting. And the sergeant was very friendly and took his information and seemed very interested. And Souter also reported his sighting to various UFO organizations. And now, immediately following this, his phone started making electronic clicking noises, and clearly something was wrong with his phone lines, which he kind of tied into this him going public with this UFO account. So he calls the phone company and to have them fix the problem, and the phone company says, well, apparently your lines are crossed with somebody else. And so Souter is now wondering, you know, if Kirtland is responsible for this, the military. So he calls again to ask Sergeant Bernheisel, and he says that he was a completely changed man. No longer was he friendly or open as he had been previously, and basically told Souter that he had discussed this UFO matter with his superiors, and that from now on the Air Force's position on the matter was that it was closed and it would not be discussed further, period. And after that, I mean, this doesn't even end there. It goes on. He says that he was accosted in his home by two men who identified themselves as police investigators but were dressed as civilians. They had badges, but he, you know, really could not verify their identity. These could have been anybody, basically. And they basically threatened him. And said that he might be harboring a fugitive, which is, you know, ludicrous and nonsensical, and that he could be imprisoned in the New Mexico State Penitentiary. So basically, this is a UFO witness being threatened for going public and becoming very vocal about it. And it's an unfortunate but, you know, not that rare example of how the Air Force sometimes reacts to these sightings. So. I mean, way as recently as Stevensville, you know, just a few years ago in Texas, there was witnesses who claimed that they were threatened and told to be silent about their sightings. So it's still going on. It's extraordinary that this cover-up, we can't seem to shake loose of it.
Because it's negative. And really, of greatest import is to collect the information, analyze, assess it, and indeed, get that power just for the information and knowledge. Harassment and intimidation always is negative.
I know you want to talk about abductions, mutilations, but I just have to mention another interesting aspect of the whole New Mexico UFO situation is there are three cases where people, and this is very, very rare. In fact, you know, I have found very, very few cases of this nature where people have been abducted and not returned. And New Mexico has three of these, which I find extraordinary. And one example occurred in September 1974 and was witnessed by the entire family. A farmer was approaching his home in Hobbs when a very large disc-shaped object, this was in September 1974, this object came right over the fields there, about 500 feet over the barn. And he drives up and he's looking up at this object, at which point suddenly his pickup is picked up, you know, lifted vertically from the ground by this object and disappears right into the underbelly of this craft. The craft darts away, and that was the last his family ever saw. Tour of course called, and this case found its way to Leonard Stringfield, who was a very well-known researcher and considered very credible, I think, in the field. And he was the one who was investigating this case and was not able to find any other information. But there's another case like that of an entire family who was abducted and not returned as well in Albuquerque. So it's pretty alarming, and I don't know exactly what to make of those types of cases. They're outliers, definitely. I'm certain they're not the norm. But it does happen, and it happened twice there in New Mexico, right in a very similar location, right over the same period of time.
You know, yes, indeed, you have mentioned, you did mention that in the book. I believe there were three instances that were very powerful. And you make a very strong point there. And that particular concept of people being abducted and never returned has been spoken of by several of the researchers. You make a very, very good point. And it's one where you have fellow researchers agreeing with you on that point, although it's a very troubling one.
Makes you wonder about missing people, doesn't it? I mean, all the people that are still missing, because there's not really a strong UFO connection in most of these. And I have a California case like that that's extraordinary, where a gentleman was, claiming to be in contact with UFOs, and he went missing, and it was never seen again. So his case has a very strong UFO connection. So, yeah, this does happen.
Very, very thought-provoking, and it is troubling. Also, after this next set of questions, I'd love to discuss the Myrna Hansen, because that would go right into the cattle mutilations as well. But, I want to note here that your research in this book extends several decades. For example, you report that on May 29th, 2010, D. Gregg, MUFON's assistant director for New Mexico, I believe D. Gregg has also just come out with a new book, sounds very interesting. D. revealed his research results on at least six possible and apparent UFO landing sites near Angel Fire, New Mexico. I remember Angel Fire. Preston is a magnificent area, a beautiful mountain scenery, but it's a very hot.
Oh, yeah. Well, all of New Mexico, I think, is very beautiful. And that's extraordinary because UFO landing cases are pretty rare. And if these are actual UFO landing marks, traces, it's extraordinary evidence. Because for the most part, UFO landing traces are very, very rare. Overall, there's about 3,000 cases, which actually is a lot. I think there's actually a lot more than that. But I'd have to look that one up. I know Ted Phillips, he's been researching this for years, and has got thousands of cases on record. But still, overall, compared to the actual number of landings and, UFO encounters, getting physical evidence is very difficult.
Yes, it is. And, kind of on an aside, rather, you were mentioning the importance of the Socorro, Lonnie Zamora encounter regarding the, he was a police officer in Socorro, and this concerned a UFO encounter outside Socorro. You mentioned the importance of the trace evidence found in that case, and I thought it was 1964. I had the date right here.
It's a very interesting case, and I'm going to say that is definitely New Mexico's most famous landing case by far, and occurred on April 24th, 1964. And although there was only one witness, Zamora was considered very, very reputable. And it's a very, very well-known case. He was actually chasing a speeder when he saw this object landing. And it kind of landed behind a hill. He drove up to the top of the hill and climbed up and looked down. He saw these two little figures standing like a weird symbol on it. And they turned and looked at him and quickly scrambled into the craft, which took off, really scaring him pretty badly, and went away. And immediately, I mean, because this guy actually was pretty connected to a lot of the military in that area. And he called them immediately, so the Air Force showed up right on the scene, not long after the sighting at all, really. And there was all kinds of physical traces on the ground, in terms of burns as well as indentations. And what's interesting is some of these, the heat that was on the ground there, the heat that the ground had been exposed to was so intense that it sort of, what's the word for it, calcified it, or you know what I mean?
Yes.
I forget exactly the word for that is, but it turned it into, welded it together almost. And there's some other extraordinary evidence, which a lot of people don't know about, is that there were some metal fragments and stuff taken from that case. Which is very, very interesting.
Yes, it is interesting. And you know, too, I've got to commend you on the additional research you did on the case. You note that regarding the Lonnie Zamora Socorro case, that about a week later, that on April 30th, 1964, and this was per the research by APRO that you investigated, a B-57 bomber pilot from Holloman Air Force Base radioed the control tower that he was observing a craft with markings similar to that seen by Socorro policeman Zamora.
Yeah, apparently, I wouldn't be surprised if it was the exact same one. Apparently, there was a lot more going on to this whole Socorro incident than we know about, because this thing actually landed at Holloman Air Force Base. And he described it the same way, egg-shaped, white, with a strange marking on the side. And it actually landed there right on the ground. And the guard was very, very distraught about this whole encounter. And, so distraught to the point that he required sedation and had to be hospitalized. And this object it leaked out of the Air Force that it was actually being held there at Holloman Air Force Base. This was a story which was told by Brad Steiger, a UFO researcher who also looked into this. And whether or not that's true, it's hard to say, because you start to get into the real murky edge of ufology. But there's no doubt that we were actually, having meetings with ETs at some point in New Mexico at Holloman Air Force Base, and that we do have their craft. That is as well as no doubt. I mean, we have cases as well where these UFOs were on Manzano Labs, which is another place, or Kirtland Air Force Base. So these objects are landing right on military bases, which, seems to me to indicate that there's a relationship there. It's not just them choosing a place to come down, land, and dig a hole and get some soil samples and induct somebody. I think they're working with our government to some degree.
Well, you note several sightings in your book regarding labs, and at least two, if I'm not mistaken. And there's one here, but in the interest of time, I won't go into it. But right now, because there are two other aspects, your book indeed covers such a wide spectrum of New Mexico events. Pardon me, Preston. Preston, you note the large number of cattle mutilations which have occurred in New Mexico. What would cause such a large cattle mutilation statistic? And, boy, interesting contemporaneous events, unmarked helicopters, mutilated animals, but also prior to that, the UFO sightings.
I think differentiates the cattle mutilation phenomenon was relatively new. I mean, this wasn't something that was going on in the 40s, certainly. We don't have any evidence of that. But so this wasn't even really noticed in New Mexico, really, until the middle of the 1970s. And immediately, they were connected to black helicopters and UFOs when ranchers started finding their steer, their cow, mutilated. And in most cases, these mutilations involved the removal of the sex organs, the eyes, the tongue, things like this, the anus, and surgically removed using something that would cauterize these wounds, leaving no blood whatsoever. So these animals were not only being, vivisected and killed, but they were being done in a manner which we could not duplicate. Normally when, you know, an animal is slaughtered, there's a great deal of blood. And there just wasn't any blood in these cases, and in fact, the bodies seemed to be drained. So this was really concerning the ranchers. It hit very quickly, very suddenly, very hard. And in fact, really got no notice at all until Linda Moulton Howe did this documentary film in 1980 called A Strange Harvest and sort of outlined it. And that's when the ranchers started getting some real attention because they were being hit financially very hard. Now, of course, the main explanation that people always raise is predators or devil worshippers. Now, these both of these are easily dismissed by, you know, even a cursory look at the evidence. And there's cases of some of these cows being found inside trees. And one rancher was able to, on a clue from other researchers, it had been discovered that sometimes UFOs leave sort of a traces which will appear on fluorescent black lights. And so this guy ran his cattle through a black light and discovered that several of them had been tagged by this substance, which was related to phosphorus, and which causes, you know, these things then to glow under a black light. And it, what was interesting is these particular cows that had this mark were the ones who were receiving these mutilations. You know, and some of these cows were being mutilated and not killed. So it's just a bizarre phenomenon, which is definitely connected to UFOs and somehow to black helicopters as well. But whether our government is behind it or not is it's a huge question.
And you know what's intriguing? You give so many related examples of cow mutilations and contemporary events. Preston, you note an account of a husband and wife on September 16th, 2008. These individuals were residents of Dulce, New Mexico, but they decided to take an early dinner in Pagosa Springs, Colorado. And en route to dinner there in Pagosa Springs, while driving on a dirt road for part of their route, they encountered two mutilated horses. Returning from dinner, they did take the same route, but they noticed this time the horses were gone, and suddenly this couple noticed a light in the sky. It approached their car. They had 2 hours of missing time. Boy, that would be a very frightening event.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the cases where UFOs are really implicated in this phenomenon. And absolutely, it is very frightening. And it's hard to say exactly what's going on or why. But researchers, you know, have looked into this, and they have discovered some patterns. And the main theory that's really popular right now is kind of told by an extraordinary coincidence. But where these mutilations are taking place is pretty much exactly where we've done atomic testing.
Yes, downwind. Mm-hmm.
So it appears that that is why they're taking place. That's the main theory. The ETs, we are keeping tabs on our food supply and how badly we've irradiated it and poisoned it. On the other hand, it's entirely possible that these ETs and some aspect of our government working with them or something like this are harvesting these cows for their genetic material, which would be hard to reproduce in any other way rather than through, you know, actually reproducing these cows. So I don't know. It's hard to say, but the evidence for it is extraordinary. These ranchers, you know, depend on this for their livelihood. They're not really the type of people who are very vocal about this sort of thing, but they've been forced to become vocal. Normally, you know, there's some very isolated places out there in New Mexico. Some of these ranches are very large, and there are several of these ranches who've been particularly hard hit in certain areas, you know, like Taos and certain particular areas, which are harder hit than others. It's the whole mutilation phenomenon is really bizarre and kind of scary. And in Colorado, are really the whole mutilation central. This is where all the mutilations are taking place, and it's still going on. You know, there's been a lot of controversy about all this within our whole government and within the New Mexico state government even. And they still don't have it resolved. It's just a complete messy situation.
Indeed, and very complicated as well. And, you know, I know, too, you have very intriguing references to Dulce, New Mexico, in your book. At least, I'd say, 5 references, if not more. Now, Preston, back on the cattle mutilation topic, you referenced the excellent work by State Police Officer Gabe Valdez from Dulce. I believe that's the case. Gabe Valdez from Dulce. Also, you note that there's also a sighting related to Dulce. You note that on October 23rd, 1988, a researcher, Linda Kurth, and a party of 8 individuals, including 2 research scientists and State Police Officer Gabe Valdez, hiking on Mount Arjuleta. I hope I correctly put Mount
Arjuleta.
Thank you, Arjuleta, quote, 5 miles northwest of Dulce, end quote, observed an object which approached Mount Arjuleta's summit. The object became extremely bright and then seemed to, quote, fold in on itself and then disappear.
Right, right. There's been a lot of speculation that there's an alien base under Dulce, and there are certainly a number of accounts in that area where people have seen UFOs coming up and out of the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There was one gentleman who was able to go onto a Native American reservation and saw that exact thing take place. And what's hard about these cases is they're very hard to verify. And mm-hmm. they'll say there's a lot of really wild conspiracy theories going on about a base where there was a war between, or a battle between humans and aliens. In this underground base at Gulf, where people died as a result of an altercation. I don't know whether this is true or not. There's other people who've been taken down into underground bases. Myrna Hansen case you mentioned.
Yes.
She had saw an abduction taking place and was actually taken down to this area where she saw an alien base. So there's a few cases like that, absolutely. I think there's no doubt that these ETs do have bases on our planet. In upstate New York, when I did research that book, there were cases of UFOs coming up out of the ground. Here in California, we've got hundreds of cases of UFOs coming up and out of the water, in and out of the water here. So it's no different in those states, and it's the same thing in New Mexico. Apparently there are bases all over the place. And certainly that's what Richard Sauder found out when he did research into this and wrote that book, UFOs in Underground Bases.
Yes, indeed. And I'd also like to just recommend to the audience your other excellent books, including UFOs Over New York and UFOs Over California, as well as many others. And your 16th book, UFOs Over Nevada, will be released next year. I can't wait to read that as well. And here I have my notes here that you reference in your book. Gabe Valdez is a state police officer from Dulce, investigated many cases, including those mutilations found at the ranch of Manuel Gomez in the Dulce region. Now, I'm correct here that magnesium potassium traces can be found at some of these mutilation sites.
Right, right. So they're starting to throw some heavy-duty research into this, because this was a big deal, and there's been high-level meetings. For example, in 1979, there was a public hearing with Senator Schmidt of New Mexico, who was a former astronaut, and at that time was a senator, and the U.S. Attorney, Ari Thompson, and all these ranchers got together, and Senator Schmidt said right out flat that these mutilations are taking place and that they are criminal acts and causing a great deal of damage. And so they are trying to put some money at this. During the proceedings, they were able to request $50,000 a federal money to investigate these mutilation reports. So, the FBI also granted $44,000 to investigate this stuff. And this is how the FBI investigated a complete bust. They basically concluded it was predators, and they could not conclude what was going on. But that case with the potassium. And, yeah, that's extraordinary. And that was fun in just a few isolated cases, but it was, you know, weird enough to think that, you know, that these cattle are being marked by these ETs in some way. It's hard to say. It's nothing that we can conclusively say is alien material or anything like that. But very bizarre, and this mutilation phenomenon just won't go away. I mean, some of this stuff takes place in areas that are very, very hard to get to, and late at night. So I don't know. It's still a problem.
Yes, indeed, some strong points there, Preston. Thank you. And, you know, your book also gives excellent details of the 1947 Roswell UFO crash. You do believe that crash occurred, apparently, and, boy, your book includes great summaries of key witnesses to the event and aftermath. And, gee, just one of the pieces of information you've given, and the photo is actually in this book. Excellent photos as well in your UFOs over New Mexico book. It is the photo that was taken by researcher Mike Hawkins on June 15th, 1997, shortly before the 50th anniversary festival of the Roswell UFO events. In this photo, you can see a disc and a helicopter apparently following it. A very strong photo, very intriguing photo.
Yeah, I was able to include a number of photos. Not as many as I would like, of course, but that was I liked that case because it actually shows this jet chasing this UFO around, and really an extraordinary case, and because that sort of thing has happened so many times in New Mexico, these jets chasing these objects back and forth, and other cases where people were photographing and didn't even see the UFOs and they only appeared, you know, small silver globes or large rectangular objects up there in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
So it's extraordinary because these days there are so many cameras out there. I think the conclusive evidence is just we're not far away from it at all. There's so much footage out there. Unfortunately, it is very easy to fake. But mm-hmm. we're at the point now where we're inundated with this. There's mountains of evidence. And it's all going to break loose. For the Roswell crash, for instance, this case is one that's not going to go away. We continue to find new witnesses. There's hundreds of witnesses at last count. I think it's pretty conclusive that this was not a mogul balloon or weather balloon or anything like that. And for me, I don't want people to give up on the Roswell case until we actually see that craft in a museum so where we can all go visit it. Because there are so many UFO crashes taking place in New Mexico that honestly, that's probably only the tip of the iceberg we're seeing. I think we probably have a good 200, 300 of these objects in our possession, at least. That would be my guess. There are UFO crashes in every state investigated so far. California, New York, and New Mexico each have their own UFO crash history. So how many of these cases are taking place is my question. Hundreds is apparently, and certainly over Nevada, it's very, very rich in that regard. So something is definitely going on.
Can't wait to read that book. And, you know, Press, you make very strong points there. The Roswell 1947 crash events have had so many witnesses. And not only that, the credentials upstanding citizens and also individuals of high military rank. For example, one of the many witness summaries you include in your book is that from the later Brigadier General Arthur E. Exon, who in his early career was stationed at Wright-Patterson at the Air Materiel Command Headquarters. Now, from the summary and the exact precise comments, your quotes, indicate that the material from the Roswell craft was extensively tested and studied and was found to be very unusual. Also, even though the MJ-12 documents are still a subject of controversy, boy, you note a very interesting point, Preston, and that is that in one document allegedly pertaining to the MJ-12 document series, the documents dated November 18th, 1952, It provides a detailed description of the 1947 UFO crash at Roswell. And you know, Preston, that linguist Dr. Roger Westcott, with among his several credentials, a 1948 Rhodes Scholar status and author of 40 books and 400 articles on linguistics, reviewed this particular memo, and he found the document to be authentic, or with a finding of authentic. He even noted that on a 1988 interview with the publication of the Roswell Record. So lots of intriguing aspects there on Roswell. Continue.
Absolutely, yeah. And as far as General Arthur Exon, he was from the Air Material Command. Now, that's what's interesting about that to me is this is where the cases that bypassed Blue Book went, cases that sort of had national security significance, or were actually, you know, what you would call a really good case, were completely bypassed the Blue Book system into the Air Material Command, and Arthur Exon was actually stationed there and assigned to the Air Material Command when the Roswell debris came in. And he confirms, this is a major guy confirming the Roswell crash, and that the wreckage was tested extensively, everything from chemical analysis and on.
Yes.
So, and as Colonel Corso says, this technology was reverse engineered. And this is another person that they have not been able to debunk. Colonel Corso is, of course, a very high-level military figure. So these are, you know, people that we can't ignore. Roswell clearly took place, and it's time we demanded that we see the craft. It's they have basically, we're having a constitutional crisis, I guess, if I would like to say. They've usurped the materials, and they have no right to it. That's my opinion.
I agree with your comments, Preston. And, you know, we're about 2 minutes before the end of this interview. Boy, I've enjoyed it. Lots of information. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. Now, Preston, I myself have visited Carlsbad, and you know your book that more than one sighting has occurred at Carlsbad Caverns. Now, one of them was a January 1980 sighting by several tourists near the mouth of the caverns. It was memorialized in a photo, as you know, analyzed by researchers Ed Walters and Bruce McAbee, an optical physicist and ufologist. Both these individuals believed the photo to be genuine. And, you know, Preston, I still remember visiting Carlsbad. It's such a steep descent to the mouth of that cavern.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. If you've never been there, you have to go there. It's one of the deepest cave systems that here in the United States. And it's a little bit ruined by the fact that there's a kind of a McDonald's restaurant at the bottom. but it's extraordinary. And, yeah, it had an extraordinary UFO case there where a gentleman photographed this object and in front of other people and could not get authorities to be interested in it, and finally did find UFO researchers Bruce McAbee, who analyzed the photograph, and definitely found that it was probably a genuine UFO. First of all, there's a red power source, which you can see is interacting with the atmosphere, and the entrance to the Carlsbad Cavern would be a very unlikely place, McAbee thought, to try to fabricate a hoax. And I agree, because it's very, very crowded there. It's definitely a very popular place.
It's steep. The descent is very steep. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's an extraordinary UFO photograph, which appears actually in one of the books by Ed Walters of Gulf Breeze. So you can see it there.
Preston, I want to thank you so much for joining us this evening as our guest. Your book, UFOs Over New Mexico, is remarkable. Even in this 2 hours, I've only had the chance to ask questions on about a quarter of the cases. Extremely extensive information. Very informative, very thought-provoking. Please return as a guest. And again, all your books and research can be reviewed at your website, or at least information details on them. Preston Dennett. Weebly.com. Preston, any final comments? We're about 30 seconds to closing the program.
Just that UFOs can go away. Open official contact is inevitable, and so is the end of the government cover-up. I think that's what we're heading towards. And I think it's very important that we take the subject seriously. And thanks, Therese, for having me on the show. I always love talking with you, and look forward to doing it next time.
I'm so glad to hear that. Thank you again, Preston. Have a great weekend. And to our audience listening, thank you so for joining us. And stay tuned. Right now, we have a new program, Insight, immediately on the air, also live. It will be with psychic medium Christopher George immediately after this program. Preston, thank you again, and please be a return guest. And I can't wait as well to read your upcoming book on Nevada. Good night, everyone. Bye-bye.